You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Asif Ali Zardari, Hamid Karzai and David Cameron meet to discuss plans for peace following NATO's withdrawal from the war in Afghanistan. We assess the role Pakistan will play in keeping the region secure.
The progress we've achieved today sends a very clear message to the Taliban. Now is the time for everyone to participate in a peaceful political process in Afghanistan.
And in Greece, one journalist's special investigation reveals how the far-right party, Golden Dawn, is recruiting support in the nation's schools. And how do you find the perfect voice for an airport? We head to Sao Paulo to find out.
Transmit the messages to the passengers in a calm, welcome and intimate way. That's what I like to do. When I do voiceovers, I try always to do.
All that, plus alleged corruption in Spain, news from the East Coast in the US, and we play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. Plenty to look forward to in the next hour, but before all that, let's catch up on the latest news headlines from around the world with Paul Osborne.
The leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan have said they'll try to secure a peace deal for Afghanistan in the next 6 months. Hamid Karzai and Asif Ali Zardari were at talks earlier in London on the future of Afghanistan once international forces leave the country. They were met by the British Prime Minister David Cameron, who said that all sides would work together to secure a more peaceful future. Mr. Karzai said he was committed to the target of achieving a resolution within 6 months.
Very much hope that all that we discussed today and the subsequent agreements that we made will be put into action to the satisfaction of all sides, and that the Taliban, as you called all them, will take this opportunity to participate in the peace process so that we in Afghanistan can all participate in building our country's future.
Spain's Prime Minister is denying allegations of corruption, saying it's totally false to suggest that members of his party have received secret payments. Mariano Rajoy has said he will stay in his post, and he's insisted that Spain will deal with its financial crisis. 60% of Spain's under-25s are currently unemployed. Andrea de la Mata is a student in Madrid.
It's like kind of a shame when you study something and you can't find the job that you're dreaming to find. I mean, you feel you've got no way of finding something.
At least 22 people have been killed in a road accident in the United Arab Emirates. Dozens more were hurt when a bus carrying South Asian workers collided with a lorry in Al Ain. Reports from the UAE say that most of the victims were from India, Bangladesh and Pakistan. European investigators have set out details of a global criminal operation which tried to fix the outcome of hundreds of soccer matches. They've said that more than 400 people, including a number of players, have been implicated. Officials say the plot is controlled from Singapore. Doctors treating Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani girl shot in the head by the Taliban, say they're pleased with the outcome of surgery to repair damage to her skull. The operation at a hospital in Birmingham in the UK also aimed to restore hearing, which was damaged in the attack. Before the surgery, Malala said she wanted to continue her campaign for girls' education. Dr. Dave Rosser from University Hospital Birmingham says staff there are amazed by her spirit.
She's already talking about resuming her work and furthering her cause about women's education. So, you know, that I think demonstrates how focused she is on that. Most of us would still be feeling sorry for ourselves 24 hours after an operation like that, not talking about helping other people.
Archaeologists have confirmed that a skeleton found under a car park in the English Midlands is that of King Richard III. It ends a 500-year mystery over the final resting place of the last English king to die in battle. Experts from the University of Leicester, the place where the remains were found, were able to trace DNA from the skeleton down his line of descendants, ending at Michael Ibsen, a Canadian-born furniture maker in London.
difficult to come to grips with. I think that there's some part of you that's part of somebody as famous or infamous as Richard III.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, President Zardari of Pakistan and his counterpart from Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, met the British Prime Minister at Chequers for talks this afternoon. On the agenda, discussing a strategic partnership to deliver peace for Afghanistan within 6 months. So what will the three parties at today's talks have learned? And did the negotiations really, as Cameron has claimed today, result in an unprecedented level of cooperation between the neighbours? We'll hear from Gareth Price, Chatham House's Senior Research Fellow on the Asia programme, in just a moment. But first, for the latest on the view on the discussions from Pakistan, we're joined on the line by Imtiaz Tayyab, Al Jazeera journalist in Islamabad. Imtiaz, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. I wanted to start by asking you simply this. How are these talks viewed from Pakistan? Is there a sense that this is something really significant between these three players in this, or is it more a feeling that this won't really change anything drastically on the ground?
Yeah, I think here in Pakistan, these trilateral talks are sort of viewed with, I don't want to use the word apathy, but there is a general sense that right now all we're hearing is an awful lot of talk and not an awful lot of substantive sort of moves towards legitimately improving the situation in Afghanistan when it comes to any kind of peace and reconciliation between the Afghan Taliban and the Afghan government. Now, there seems to be this sort of generally sort of pervasive view that Pakistan, particularly when it comes to the Afghan Taliban, has such influence over them that they can almost say to the Afghan leadership, you know, almost if Pakistan says to them to jump, that the Afghan Taliban will say how high. And that's not really the kind of influence that the Pakistanis have over the Afghan Taliban. Still, if you look historically, especially when the Afghan Taliban were in charge of Afghanistan, were effectively the government of Afghanistan, Pakistan was one of the few countries that recognized that leadership. So they do have a bit of sway. But if you take it down to a people-to-people level here in Pakistan, many Pakistanis really just see the only way that Afghanistan is going to stabilize is if foreign forces leave. And whether that's the truth or not, one can only sort of speculate. However, on the ground here, many people just feel if foreign forces leave, Afghanistan may perhaps get better. But again, that is a bit harder to qualify, really, until we actually see what happens post-2014.
Now, I just wondered what the view is there in terms of Zardari's position. Do people feel that it's actually rather irrelevant and this is just a matter for, you know, the Pakistan military and that's all that really counts?
Yeah, I think so. But it's a complicated one to answer. On the one hand, yes, absolutely. Many people see that whatever happens in Afghanistan is going to be a grand game played by the Pakistani military, the Afghan leadership, and quite frankly, the U.S. But the reality is that for the Pakistani government, it is very important for them, at least from an optics point of view, to be a part of these talks and to be seen on the world stage as having some sort of say over what's going to happen in the region, particularly about this specific issue, which really has destabilized, of course, Afghanistan, but particularly Pakistan as well. Keep in mind, since 2010, since 2003, since the invasion, shortly after 2001, rather, Pakistan has seen levels of violence really quite unprecedented in Pakistani history. And so the civilian government has always played a very minor role when it comes to negotiating what happens. But as we're heading into an election here in Pakistan, as we're looking to see one civilian government possibly handing over power to another civilian government for the first time in Pakistan's history, it is quite important for Zardari to play a role, but I think you're right in that many people do see this as something that the military is going to have any kind of ultimate say in.
Imtiaz Tayeb in Islamabad, thanks for joining us. Gareth, welcome to Midori House. If I can turn to you now, do these talks today, do you, in your view, represent any kind of significant shift in position from any of these main players?
I think it's a fair point that was just made about the gap between rhetoric and substance. But I think you have seen quite a substantial rhetorical shift, particularly from Pakistan, over the past few months. And the commitments made today towards getting a peace process going and even completed over the next few months is, from the Pakistani side, you know, that's a big shift. And, you know, it is the shift from Pakistan's military. And I think, you know, it's a positive signal.
And how would you characterise what Pakistan has to gain then from this? Because it's obviously a tricky one to balance whether the withdrawal will go ahead as planned on time. What's the key considerations then from the Pakistani side?
I think what you've seen over the past few years is a shift towards Pakistan accepting that the biggest threat to Pakistan is internal stability. You know, it's taken a long time and it's the message that the Americans have been saying for many years. But it would seem that, you know, rhetorically at least, you know, Pakistan would prefer, needs to tackle its own security challenges. And, you know, the best outcome for Pakistan is a stable Afghanistan, not an Afghanistan in which Pakistan is struggling to be the dominant external player.
And is there a difference between how the Taliban are perceived and actually the difference on the ground between the Taliban within Afghanistan and within the sort of Pakistani Taliban, if you like? The reading is, I guess, that the Taliban in Afghanistan is a more sort of a cohesive group. The Taliban in Pakistan doesn't work in quite the same way. Is that a fair summary of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference. I mean, historically, Pakistan has seen the Taliban in Afghanistan, as well as Islamist groups in Indian Kashmir, as an arm of its foreign policy. Whereas when these groups or people with similar ideologies are active in Pakistan, that's against the Pakistani state. I mean, that's the sort of blowback that Pakistan's undergoing. But there has been a shift, you know, away from the Taliban or away from projecting proxies in neighbouring countries. I mean, that's been the shift over the past few years. Now, it's not, they're not completely delinked, but, you know, this is a gradual process that's underway that was manifest in these talks in London over the weekend.
And just looking at those the talks, I'm intrigued by the sort of personalities involved. There's a perception, I don't know whether you'd consider this fair or not, that Hamid Karzai is something of a lame duck. Zardari, similarly, the ground around him fairly fragile. Do you think these are individuals who sort of have the authority to be taken seriously, both within the talks and kind of on the wider stage?
I mean, I think the point about Zardari or whoever succeeds him as president of Pakistan is that their ability to act is going to be determined by Pakistan's military. And if there is a genuine shift amongst Pakistan's military, then, you know, I think there is legitimacy on the Pakistan side. In the case of Karzai, he's got a year or so to go. And if he's looking for a legacy, this would be it.
And just looking across to the US, what do you think the US will have made of today's developments? They've obviously been attempting to talk to Pakistan quite often. They're a critical ally in the region. What will they have made of today's discussions?
I think that's an interesting question because, you know, this peace process, this reconciliation, however it's formulated, has been under discussion for the last 4 years. So one of the big stumbling blocks is actually who talks to who. So the formulation out of this is that the Afghan High Peace Council will talk to the Taliban in Qatar. But there's been times in the past when the Taliban have said, we want to talk to, you know, the real puppet masters, if you like, which is the United States. So what the Taliban's reaction is probably going to be as interesting as what the Americans make of it.
And Gareth, just to sort of put you on the spot slightly, it's obviously hard to predict how these things will play out. What do you think the response to this will be, particularly from the Taliban? Because obviously you've got one of these groups where perhaps the perception is that, you know, more uncertainty, more instability actually suits them. They retain that sort of key role during instability. Will the Taliban have any appetite to deal with any of these players?
I think we'll find out by their response how things go. I mean, there's been a lot of projection of what, you know, what the West wants onto what the Taliban is. So, you know, in the 90s there were moderate Taliban. Post 9/11 they were all hardliners and connected with Al-Qaeda. And as the talk of having a political process has increased, you know, we're suddenly saying that there's a lot of moderates within the Taliban and we can engage with them. And I think, frankly, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating.
It will indeed. Perhaps Gareth, you can come back and talk to us once we learn a little more. That was Gareth Price from Chatham House. Coming up next on Midori House, we'll be exploring the growing appeal of Greece's Extreme Nationalist Party, a special investigation into their recruiting process in the nation's schools.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 1816 here in London. Now, the success of the far-right party, Golden Dawn, during the months of unrest and disorder that have followed the Greek financial crisis have been well documented. And with anticipated levels of support at the ballot box growing all the time, many in Athens and further afield have voiced their concerns about the group's influence, particularly in terms of the next generation, those young people who remain too young to vote, but whose formative political experiences are increasingly shaped by parties on the fringes of the mainstream. Natalie Savarikas, a journalist in Athens, has conducted a major investigation into Golden Dawn's rising popularity amongst young people. She joined me a little earlier to explain why this was such an important issue.
Well, what intrigued me the most was that today's teens are tomorrow's voters, and we're experiencing in Greece a radical shift, if you like, in the how the Greek vote, what they're appealed to, what their beliefs in the Greek political establishment. So I wanted to understand what's the source of this all, and especially when it comes to the younger generation that has been really shaken by this three-year-old crisis now.
And tell us a little bit about the kind of strategy then that Golden Dawn is pursuing, because it seems to be quite sort of insidious the way they're trying to target and focus younger people. Is that a fair reading of the situation?
So the way Golden Dawn first decided to, if you like, appeal to the younger generation was from grassroots mobilizations in neighborhoods that were experiencing a rise in crime, and of course the poorer areas of Greece. After that, it started mobilizing itself in different ways. One was music, which is a very subtle form to appeal to the young people, and the lyrics in the music that they use is extremely powerful. Two of the party's MPs are bass players for popular skinhead rock black metal groups, if you like. I just put all of these genres in the same way. And they were using very violent messages, if you like, pushing these messages to the young people. One of the names of the song was called Speak Greek or Die, and the other one was called Auschwitz. On the other hand, you have a more, if you like, other subtle ways, which was essentially in these neighborhoods that had witnessed the rise of crime. They were essentially going to young people and giving them their mobile phone numbers in case they need any help. You know, the feeling that these kids are not alone, that they belong somewhere, that they will be protected. And that's what the younger generation now really needs from their parents, from society, just that they're not alone.
And Natalie, what intrigues me then is this about a generation then of younger people who are making politically informed choices? Or is there an element of the appeal often to teenagers and younger people of countercultural movements? Is it almost like more likely a cultural movement rather than a political one? Are these young people actually making choices based on politics and economics? Are they assessing the situation? Or is it more reactionary and more about a countercultural movement that happens to appeal to young people like we see all around the world?
I think it's a bit of both. It's mainly angry youth that are appealed by the anti-establishment features of this party, the way it just goes against the system, the way it barks at politicians, the way it decides to be violent against these corrupt, if you like, as they call them, politicians that are guilty and responsible for the way the country, for the predicament of this country today. And on the other hand, there are children that I spoke to that were reading Golden Dawn rhetoric and could, if you like, in some way understand it. Because, you know, Golden Dawn, despite all this fascist and far-right rhetoric, there is some part of it that can make sense to young people who have fallen victim to crime, who feel that their country and the political system and the policing of this country is not up to date. It's not strong enough to protect them, and that's why they want something stronger, the big brother, if you like, to help them through this economic storm. But of course, the most important part of it all is, as I mentioned again, the feeling of being protected by Golden Dawn that offers different solutions to this crisis, different faces, more youthful faces, young people who are actively involved in what's happening in Greece and not just offering some vague type of solution to the overall problem.
Now, Natalie, I wondered, how surprised were you how forthright and how candid a lot of these young people were when you spoke to them about their involvement with Golden Dawn, the appeal that Golden Dawn had to them? And do you think that that suggests, as you said, this generation now are the next generation of voters? Does it, to your mind, suggest that Golden Dawn is managing to fully immerse itself into the mainstream of Greek politics?
Well, that's the worrying aspect, that indeed Golden Dawn is becoming quite mainstream. The children I was talking to, I was really trying to make myself approachable, that they could talk to me. Honestly, I wasn't critical of their beliefs, and you can't really be critical because they don't really have a fully formed opinion. They don't really know what fascism means. They don't really know what Nazism might mean. These are all, if you like, vague and abstract notions that they were briefly taught in a classroom. No one really explained how difficult it was to live under the Greece's dictatorship that was just 30 years ago. These are all notions that don't resonate with them any longer. So I was trying to understand what was behind all this anger that they felt against the system and how this was channeled in their political preferences. And to be quite honest, they were ordinary kids that were very worried about their future, very worried about where Greece was going.
That was the journalist Natalie Savarikas speaking to me there from Athens a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House. Now, as if Spain's economic crisis was not bad enough, there's now a weighty political problem to boot. The country's Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, is under pressure to resign following allegations of corruption against senior members, including himself, within his political party, the PP. Rajoy was forced to make a televised address this weekend, denying he'd personally benefited from a secret slush fund paid by companies competing for government contracts. Miles Johnson, Madrid correspondent for the Financial Times, spoke to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, before we came on air.
This is effectively, you know, Mariano Rajoy and the Partido Popular's Watergate. You know, this could be a Watergate moment. I mean, that sounds quite sensationalist, but I mean, this is really allegations and documentary evidence claimed by the country's biggest selling newspaper, El País, that Rajoy and other senior members of his party were taking money in cash for over a decade. I mean, very, very serious allegations indeed. There were protests on, you know, small but still symbolically important protests on the streets outside their central Madrid headquarters.
And these allegations go back to a period, well, two governments ago now, José Mari Aznar's government, which lost power in 2008. So, I mean, is Aznar believed to be involved in this as well, or is it just ministers within that government at the time?
There were some insinuations that Aznar was mentioned in the accounts which El País had got, but I mean, Aznar has, again, he's apparently launched some sort of legal defense for himself, in the sense that he doesn't feel that he has anything, it has nothing to do with him, and, you know, thinks that it's very bad that he's been mentioned. But I mean, look, the important thing is that, you know, Spain is a relatively young democracy. You know, the sort of transition from the Franco dictatorship only happened in, you know, the 1970s, and this political party, the PP, is, you know, a relatively young but still important part of Spanish democracy. And these allegations would mean, if proven true, that basically one of the most important pillars of the Spanish democracy, as one of its main political parties, has been corrupt throughout all of its leadership for over a generation, which would be a very large blow to a country which is already suffering in sort of institutional crises in other parts, you know, ranging from the monarchy and corruption scandals involving the family of the king to senior judges and an entirely discredited business class. So there is a real risk that people start to lose faith in the pillars of what has made up, you know, a relatively young Spanish democracy.
Has there been much discussion about how El País put together this story in terms of, you know, how long their investigation has been, how careful they've been about ensuring and double-checking and triple-checking everything?
Well, yes, that has started to become more of an issue because, you know, for a start, we've had the document they claim to have is from the treasurer, the former treasurer of the party called Luis Bárcenas, and it's in his handwriting, or so handwriting experts claim. But recently, another paper, ABC, a rival paper, has had its own expert in to show that it's actually maybe likely these documents were written in one sitting, which would then provide, you know, would appear quite strange, you know, if the accounts over, you know, 10 years or more was all written in one go, it would look rather strange. But yeah, so there is a lot of scrutiny going on. I mean, but we should add, it's not just El País which has reported these things, you know, also El Mundo, which is, you know, El País sits to the sort of center-left, El Mundo more to the right. Mm. And, you know, so, you know, El País, you could argue, would have maybe less, you know, less affinity with a conservative government, but El Mundo, conservative rival, has also been reporting that these payments took place. So at the moment, you know, the government has denied it, but they still have a lot to answer for. They need to really make a very large effort to launch some form of internal inquiry which satisfies a very sceptical Spanish population that there was no wrongdoing here.
Well, quite. I want to ask you about, you know, the inquiry and what comes next. At what stage does the police get involved, or do judges get involved? Are the opposition calling for an independent inquiry, or is it something that Rajoy thinks he can probably head off by appointing someone himself?
Well, I think before last Thursday, which is when the El País accounting photocopies were sort of published, that was when Rajoy probably thought he could get over this by just having an internal inquiry. But since then, it's really exploded. And, you know, we've had the leader of the opposition here has actually called for Rajoy's resignation, or for him to step aside in the interim period whilst there is an investigation. So that's a very serious thing for him to say. I think at the moment there's no sign that the police directly going to get involved. Spain's lead prosecutor has said that there would be cause to investigate. But this is another problem, is that the Spanish court system is notoriously slow. So there are literally hundreds of political corruption cases sitting within the court system, sort of gathering dust, which take maybe 4 or 5 years to resolve. And eventually, when they are resolved, everyone's sort of moved on and forgotten about them. So I think what we need to see here is sort of swift action, because, you know, the traditional way of doing things will not work.
And just finally, I mean, it's not as if Rajoy didn't have enough on his plate anyway with, he's got an economic crisis. We understand now that, you know, as many as 60% of Spain's young people are officially unemployed. You have potential secessionist movements such as the one in Catalonia. How does he deal then with the other crises swirling around his government while this is going on as well?
Well, I mean, as you say, you know, Mr. Rajoy has a bulging inbox. But I think he is, you know, he has made progress on, you know, in some of the things he said he was going to do last year, you know, reforming the labor market, reforming the banking sector. He has pushed ahead with those reforms. The question is whether they're going to work. I mean, with regards to Catalonia, yes, it still is a problem which he needs to deal with very delicately. It's a situation which needs a subtle touch, and you know, we'll see if Rajoy is up to doing that. In regards to this political scandal, he really just needs to sort of act swiftly to show. I mean, one thing which is important, which I haven't mentioned, he's going to publish his accounts this week. He's going to publish his tax returns this week, Rajoy, which is quite an extraordinary step, if you can recall, you know, what happened in sort of, for example, in American politics with Barack Obama. So it's interesting. We'll see what happens. I don't know if he's going to succeed or not, but at the moment, there's a lot of pressure on him.
That was Miles Johnson of the Financial Times in Madrid speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. And now in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be crossing to New York for the latest from the East Coast. It won't just be the Super Bowl, I promise. And we'll find out exactly how the new voice of an airport in Brazil sounds.
Welcome to GRU Airport, the São Paulo International Airport.
All that and more coming up. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
The leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan have said they'll try to secure a peace deal for Afghanistan within 6 months. Hamid Karzai and Asif Ali Zardari were at talks earlier in London on the future of Afghanistan once international forces leave the country. Spain's Prime Minister is denying allegations of corruption, saying it's totally false to suggest that members of his party have received secret payments. Mariano Rajoy has said he will stay in his post. He's also insisted Spain will deal with its financial crisis. At least 22 people have been killed in a road accident in the United Arab Emirates. Dozens more were hurt when a bus carrying workers from India, Pakistan and Bangladesh collided with a lorry in Alin. Doctors treating Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani girl who was shot in the head by the Taliban, have said they're pleased with the outcome of surgery to repair damage to her skull. Before the operation, Malala had said she wanted to continue her campaign for girls' education. And European investigators have set out details of a global criminal operation trying to fix the outcome of hundreds of soccer matches. They've said more than 400 people have been implicated, including a number of players. Officials say the plot is centred on Singapore. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Next up, we're heading to the USA and we're joined by our voice on the East Coast, Aisha Spears, our New York bureau chief, who's with us with the latest news from the States. And now, Aisha, I was going to ask what's caught your eye today, but I guess the day after Super Bowl Sunday, there's only ever one place to start.
There is. Super Bowl takes over the United States on this current Sunday, on the last Sunday, and apparently I think something like 75% of the national viewing audience was tuned into the Super Bowl, and this year was a particularly controversial one as there was a blackout quite inconveniently right in the middle of the biggest sports game in the United States.
Now, what does the American public make of that? Does everyone say, oh, it's a conspiracy theory, or is the team who is trailing in the game, people suggest that they've thrown a switch, or are people fairly patient? I can't imagine that the Super Bowl audience is that patient a bunch.
Well, they're kind of well lubricated with a lot of beer, so I think that probably helped the situation. A lot of people were commenting this is a kind of a symbol of the American energy position. You know, they're blowing up this huge studio with all these lights, all these ads, all these performances, and all of a sudden the power goes out. It was out for 34 minutes, which was quite awkward because you had these two teams who'd been gearing up for months to be at this situation, and they're kind of stretching and trying to keep warmed up on the field. The cheerleaders were still cheering, which really confused me. So you saw shots of people covering it with these cheerleaders flying out in the air. And I think the biggest problem would have probably been for the advertisers, because as we know, Super Bowl ads, which are very, very kind of structured, you know when you're getting your slot, they're paying up to about $4 million to be on these, to have these ads going. And that was all kind of messed up. But what it did do for the game is it got a lot more people watching, because I assume people heard that the lights had gone out in New Orleans. So a lot of people tuned joined in and also helped the 49ers, who ended up losing, and they were losing before the blackout, but they kind of got a little bit more energy back. Perhaps one of the weirdest things was that it was at the Superdome in New Orleans, which obviously in 2005 was a quite horrible scene during Hurricane Katrina. And so a lot of people were making quite crude comments linking the power blackout that then to the power blackout in 2005.
That sounds rather unfortunate. But on a brighter note, as you said, it was actually a great game. I watched a little of it, but I had to get my beauty sleep, so I didn't tune into the bitter end. But I gather that as frequently, the halftime show often ends up getting more column inches almost than the actual play action. Who was who dazzled this year?
It was dazzling. It was Beyonce, who I am a big fan of, but I thought she was a little terrifying for this performance. So obviously she's made the headlines for the inauguration. She sang, and then it turned out that she was lip-syncing. For the press conference ahead of the Super Bowl, she sang, saying, "I could sing the national anthem if I wanted to, but I chose not to at the inauguration. However, I will be singing live at the Super Bowl." She was really on one. I mean, her eyes were really intense. It was all over the place. Destiny's Child kind of made a reunion, which I think pleased a lot of 20-something-year-old women. Women around town who are watching the Super Bowl with their boyfriends. So it was a big performance, a lot of money behind the show, but I actually tuned in for the football rather than Beyonce.
Fair play to you. Well, maybe we'll be hearing from Beyonce in a few minutes' time. Who knows? We just have to play our cards right. On to slightly more serious matters. John Kerry has obviously just taken up his office. How's he been spending his first weekend? Has he been a busy man? Has he been upsetting anybody?
He's been a busy man. He's been making a lot of phone calls this weekend. So he did take, he was in the State Department for the first time in his new position today. Actually, a little link to all the single ladies. He was saying that he's got some big heels to fill with regards to Hillary Clinton, seeing as he's the first male Secretary of State for 8 years with Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice. So there was a little bit of girl power going on this morning in the State Department. But over the weekend, he called the leaders of many countries, including Palestine and Israel. He pledged to Mahmoud Abbas that he would continue efforts in Congress to release budget support for the Palestinian Authority, and it's likely that over the next week what he'll be doing is making more calls to leaders around the world.
And just tell me, Aisha, in terms of what the sort of mood is, you know, on the street in New York, what do people think about John Kerry? He was obviously a fairly safe appointment, it wasn't that surprising, but do people think he's the kind of man who can really deliver, can do the kind of big stage, statesman-like work that's needed? Are people optimistic about the contribution he's going to be making?
I think so. I mean, he really is a statesman. He has a lot of history in foreign affairs for the United States. You know, he held up his passport this morning in the State Department, his first diplomatic passport that he received when he was 11 years old, when his father, who was a Foreign Service diplomat, traveled to post-World War II Germany. So he kind of showed that he really knows what he's doing. It's a very different role from what Hillary Clinton played. But obviously, she's a very popular lady. I think people will be interested to see if he takes policy away from the West Wing and directly just doing what Obama wants, which is what we think Hillary Clinton did, and if he's got his own vision for how the United States will operate their foreign policy.
Now, finally, Aisha, I wanted to ask you about a big announcement from the governor of New York in terms of a reaction to some of the land that suffered damage during the storm Sandy. Tell us what he's had to say.
So Governor Cuomo has been very vocal about how we will recover and how we will be kind of proactive in the light of climate change and more storms coming towards this region. And he's announced that he wants to spend up to $400 million on purchasing land where homes were destroyed by Hurricane Sandy in order to preserve the coastline as undeveloped and as protection. So turning these homes into sand dunes and parks and areas where people can't live. It's a pretty bold policy. It's going to require approval from federal officials. FEMA in the past have purchased homes affected by storms, but not on this scale. It really would mean that residents will have to move out of communities that they perhaps have been part of, their families have been part of for generations. He's offering prices that were pre-hurricane prices for their homes. So other people getting certain deals. There's all sorts of incentives to move. It's unlikely it's going to happen on the scale that he wants it to happen, though.
It's an interesting one. We'll have to keep a close eye on it. Aisha Spears, New York Bureau Chief, thanks as always for joining us. Now, I wanted to hear from one of the stars of last night's Super Bowl. Well, I wanted to hear what Jacoby Jones of the Baltimore Ravens had to say, but I gather we're going to hear instead from one of the other stars who you already mentioned.
We are Beyonce, or Mrs. Carter, as she's now calling herself, and I think this is Crazy in Love.
History in the making.
That was Beyoncé there, star of yesterday's Super Bowl halftime show with Crazy in Love. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this to find out how you brand the voice of an airport. Stay tuned.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 18:41 here in London. The International Airport of Sao Paulo just announced their first ever official voice for important messages to passengers. As part of recent sound branding strategy, passengers will be able to hear the soft tones of voiceover artist Simone Clias. Earlier today, I spoke with Simone about what it's like to be the voice of the biggest Brazilian airport. I started by asking her if she was excited about the prospect of welcoming millions of visitors into the country.
Exactly, I am, Tom, and especially now that Brazil is growing and the airport is being expanded and renovated, and the airport, the GRU airport, is getting ready to receive more and more people because of the World Cup in 2004, the Olympics at 2016, many other big events, and for me it's huge pleasure to be part of this sound branding project. I'm very happy.
And now tell me, Simone, why do you think it was that they picked, I think our listeners will have a pretty good idea already, why you were chosen for this job. What is it about your particular accent that makes it so charming to international audiences?
Tom, thank you. But Zana will tell more. Zana, that is responsible for the sound branding project, and she's going to talk to you too. But what she asked me to do is transmit the messages to the passengers in a calm, welcome, and intimate way. That's what I like to do. When I do voiceovers, I try always to do, not always, because some clients need other things, but I try to deliver voiceovers like this, to calm people, to be nice, and I like this kind of voiceover, and they wanted a person who do this kind of voiceover, so I think we met.
Well, I feel very calm speaking to you, so it's obviously working. I wondered if you might, can you remember some of the particular...
Calm, Tom, because I'm trying, but I'm Brazilian and English, and especially in the phone, for me it's a little hard, but... You are making me calm, so thank you.
Oh, that's good that that's working. I just wondered, can you remember some of the messages you have to give? What sort of things did you record? I know that there's some perhaps about alerting children not to walk on their own away from their parents, or what were the kind of announcements you had to record for this project?
That the passengers should know that they are responsible for the content of their luggage, that they can't smoke in the Brazilian international airport. It's not allowed. And a lot of messages. And we record also the on-hold telephone messages.
A truly multimedia experience. I just wondered, it might be nice for our listeners, because our Monocle 24 listeners are all around the world, maybe to compare the three different language versions. Would you be able to do that for us?
Let's see what I have. I have here the test. Welcome to GRU Airport, the São Paulo International Airport. In Portuguese is Você ligou para GRU Airport, Aeroporto Internacional de São Paulo. Seja bem-vindo. Seja bem-vindo. And in Spanish is GRU Airport, Aeropuerto Internacional de São Paulo. Bienvenido.
Oh, that's super. I think I must say I did think that Portuguese is my favorite, Simone, to be honest, out of those.
Really?
Yeah, just about.
It's a very beautiful language, right?
It's one of my favorites, certainly. Now just tell me, what do you think the most exciting aspect of this is going to be? Are you excited that, as you mentioned before, all of the people who will be arriving in São Paulo and in Brazil in the next few years are all going to be welcomed by your voice? Is that a big responsibility or something you're looking forward to?
Yeah, it's a big responsibility. Like I told you, Brazil is getting bigger and bigger. We have a strong economy here. And more Brazilians are taking to air, too. So it's not only the people from other countries, but more Brazilians are traveling nowadays. So I'm very happy to be part of this huge project and this huge expansion and renovate. So it's exciting. It's very exciting.
That was the voiceover artist Simone Clias talking to me a little earlier. Now, to tell us a little more about this project, we're joined on the line by Zana, owner of the sound branding company, Zana Sound. Zana, hello, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for joining us. Just tell me, we've been hearing from Simone then. I think it's fairly obvious why you selected her. Tell us about what it was that makes her voice so perfect for this kind of task.
Hi, Edward. Thank you for the invitation. I love to talk about this case because, you know, it's something really new and refreshing for us here. Talking about Simone's voice, we were searching for something special, like a more natural, someone that could speak not as an answer machine or something like that. We're searching for a special and totally natural voice, even if she doesn't really have that perfect English accent. But I think this is the charming thing, and even speaking Spanish, the same thing. Like, it's a natural, very close. How I can say that? Like, it's a kind of closeness you can feel when you hear Simone speaking. So this was exactly what I was searching for, and I found him in her.
Now tell me about doing a sound branding project like this. What are the particular kind of challenges? As you said, there's an intimacy, I suppose, and a friendliness that you're trying to capture. But how do you make sure that the whole airport, the whole project, remains true to the brand, if you like? What are the kind of challenges you face?
The first thing is, like, the scenario in Brazil, like, I always say, hey, guys, airports are not a bus station. And sometimes, because you have a lot of air companies speaking at the same time, announcing flights and everything, sometimes becomes a little bit a bus station or something like that. Like, my first thing, and I'm sure that the airport marketing from airport was feeling the same thing, is we wanted to make the sound cleaner, you know, make it more sophisticated also, you know, because the airport definitely it's a more sophisticated environment. So the first thing that we did to get there was to study. So we put together like a four personality attributes and make sure that the musical theme was expressing this personality attributes, which is innovative, because it's the first Brazilian airport to have a sound branding project. It's dynamic because it's the biggest airport in Latin America. It's multicultural because it's international and the biggest in Latin America, and the closeness. So the musical theme has all these attributes. From the musical theme, we took away the sound logo, and then the voice, like the choice of the voice would be the other element that would compose all of that. So we need, we have today this in these messages, in all of the sound design of the airport, you have a voice specific and exactly the way we want it. You have the sound logo that will make people recognize when a message from the airport is coming, and a musical theme that makes people definitely feels good, feels relaxed. I don't know if you heard the sound theme, did you?
We didn't hear that, Zana, but we did hear the from Simone herself, and I can assure you that I think you've done a terrific job. I can't wait to visit. That's Zana. Many thanks for joining us on Midori House, and thanks for your insights. Staying in Brazil, here's Gilberto Gil and Aquel Abrazo.
O Rio de Janeiro, fevereiro e março. Alô, alô, Realengo. Aquele abraço. Alô, torcida do Flamengo. Aquele abraço. Chacrinha continua balançando a pança e buzinando a moça e comandando a massa e continua dando as ordens no terreiro. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha, velho guerreiro. Alô, alô, Terezinha, Rio de Janeiro. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha, velho palhaço. Alô, alô, Terezinha. Sendo o Rio de Janeiro, fevereiro e março. Alô, alô, Realengo! Alô, torcida do Flamengo! Alô, alô, Realengo! Alô, torcida do Flamengo! Aquele abraço! Olha o moleque! Chacrinha continua balançando a pança e buzinando a moça e comandando a massa.
That was Gilberto Gil with Aquel Abrazo. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. We're off to Italy next. The journalist and writer Bill Emmett has joined with filmmaker Annalisa Piras to explore Italy's political, economic and social decline over the past 20 years, the product of a supposed moral collapse unmatched anywhere else in the West. The finished product, a documentary, Girlfriend in a Coma, was set to premiere at Rome's Fondazione Maxi Art Museum this February, with a private attendees list of Italy's good, bad, and perhaps those in the crosshairs of the journalist's aim. Yet, astonishingly, it's been banned by the Ministry for Culture and the Maxi itself. In a moment, we'll hear from Bill Emmett, but first, here's a taster of what the Roman public is missing out on.
Girlfriend in a coma, I know, it's really serious.
It all began in 2001 when I was editor of The Economist. We looked at Italy and we were shocked. corruption, private power, media domination. Our precious capitalism was destroying something even more precious, democracy. On our cover, we were a trifle provocative about Silvio Berlusconi. He sued us for libel and said we were communists. His proof that I look like Lenin. We won the legal cases. He won two more elections.
And Bill Emmett, creator of the documentary, joins me now. Bill, you mentioned there your shock at some of the things you discovered when you were back in Italy during those years. Does that match the shock you felt when you learned of the decision about this premiere of your documentary?
Well, I was shocked when the director of Maxi suddenly revoked our booking. Although, with hindsight, after a little while to think about it, I shouldn't have been. Why not? Well, one of the shocking things about Italy is the politicization of institutions, cultural, even media institutions, all sorts of state institutions, incredibly politicized. And that's really what this is a case of. So I shouldn't have been surprised. This state-run museum, although it's managed by a private foundation, suddenly decided to cancel my film, essentially for political reasons, because it was too controversial just ahead of the elections. So I shouldn't have been shocked. Of course, in a way, I'm pleased because it's caused a lot of publicity in Italy, and so a lot of more people know about the film that would have known otherwise.
So it's not perhaps all bad news. But I just wonder, though, looking at, well, attempting to look objectively at it, do you think that we would ever see a situation like this, you know, if this film was happening, for instance, in this country? I know you've written in your blog about this. I mean, it's inconceivable, is it, that, you know, a similar movie about or a documentary about the same kind of issues in Britain, for example, would never be treated this way? Or is that my overreaction?
I think you're absolutely correct. I think that the reason it wouldn't be is because, let's say, the equivalent institutions, Tate Modern or the Institute for Contemporary Arts or even the British Museum, are sufficiently independent. They're not politicized. They're run totally independently. We have a tradition of them being independent that nobody would bat an eyelid at, say, an Italian journalist's view of Britain being broadcast 10 days before the British election. No one would think it was important. So it really reflects this highly politicized nature of institutions in Italy, and I think a certain cowardice among some of the people running them. It was a foolish act to ban this film because she has the director, Giovanna Melandri, has attracted a lot more attention both to herself and to the film than otherwise. But actually, it was also a cowardly act. I think it was a defensive, cautious sort of act. She wanted to avoid criticism from within her own political party, which is actually the left-wing political party, her party, even though the film is much more critical of my old friend Silvio Berlusconi.
Now, Bill, just wanted to ask you fairly briefly then, how would you characterise this film you've made? Is it a political film? I mean, obviously, you've spoke to the likes of Umberto Eco, Roberto Saviano, who are very outspoken and quite notorious in some respects. But is this an explicitly political film, or is it, an objective piece of documentary making?
Well, everything is political, I think, and so I shouldn't dismiss politics, but it's not party political. It's an attempt to show through a foreigner's eyes the reality of what has happened in Italy over the past 20 years under governments of all types, left and right, and because of sins committed by people of all types, left and right. So it has political connotations and political implications, but it's not party political.
Bill Emmett, thank you very much for joining us on today's Midori House. That's Bill Emmett, the journalist and, well, now filmmaker. Girlfriend in a Coma is this controversial picture. I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Alad John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and, of course, our studio manager, Ben Jay. Next up, we'll join Robert Bound for a brand new edition of Culture, where we'll be attending a couple of entertainment industry events to see if they're still the place to make business deals, starting at the music industry showcase MIDEM in Cannes. In 3 hours' time, 2200 hours here in London, Marco Sippi and Louise Beale will be back for the Monocle Daily. Thanks very much for listening to today's Midori House. I've been Tom Edwards. Goodbye.